Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Cassidy Craighill of Greenpeace USA, who assesses the climate issues that were the focus of some of the many protest actions at the recent G20 summit meeting of world leaders in Hamburg, Germany. Tony Harp, mayor of New Haven, Connecticut, who talks about resolutions calling for reductions in U.S. military spending that were adopted at the recent annual meeting of the U.S. Conference of Mayors. And Annie Bird, director of the Guatemala Human Rights Commission, who discusses a recent investigation into a 2012 DEA-led drug raid in Honduras that killed 4 civilians, which demands accountability. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
As Venezuela's political crisis continued to escalate, with a recent attack by government supporters targeting the opposition-controlled National Assembly, Mexico is working within the Organization of American States to negotiate a settlement between Venezuela's socialist president, Nicolas Maduro, and his political opponents. Mexico's president, Enrique Peña Nieto, has his own political future in mind as he focuses on Venezuela's turmoil. In next year's presidential election, Nieto's party, the ruling Institutional Revolutionary Party, or PRI, will face a formidable challenge from former Mexico City Mayor Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who narrowly lost the 2006 presidential race after being linked to Venezuela's leftist president Hugo Chávez. Nieto, who lost public support over his humiliating early dealings with Donald Trump, is now looking to play the Venezuela card in order to undercut his populist challenger. According to Armand Pichard's Fredroup of the center-right think tank, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Mexico's political establishment has often exploited fear of a leftist takeover to isolate progressive candidates. However, there's an irony in Mexico drawing attention to rights abuses elsewhere in the hemisphere when its own human rights record is under severe scrutiny. Berta Zuniga, the daughter of slain rainforest activist Berta Cáceres, survived a violent attack only weeks after taking over the indigenous rights group her mother founded. Cáceres, the recipient of the prestigious Goldman Environmental Prize, was murdered in her home in March of 2016. Zuniga and two leading members of the Civic Council of Popular and Indigenous Organizations in Honduras were attacked during a community visit. The trio was blocked by a truck filled with men wielding machetes, and attackers later attempted to run Zuniga and her associate's vehicle off a cliff-edged road. Berta Cáceres, whose murder triggered international outrage, had for years faced intimidation and death threats. She had fought to defend the ancestral rights of the Lenca people from miners, loggers, and dam construction. 8 men were later arrested for Cáceres' murder, including 3 with links to the military, and others who worked for a construction company that built dams that the environmental activists opposed. More than 120 environmental activists have been killed in Honduras since a military-backed coup in 2009. After weeks of negotiations, California Governor Jerry Brown announced a proposed extension of the state's pioneering cap-and-trade carbon emissions program. The governor and legislative leaders will give new powers to the State Air Resources Board that will set a price for carbon in addition to monitoring fossil fuel industry pollution. During talks over the cap-and-trade program, Brown played an insider strategy. Instead of embracing progressive legislation endorsed by climate justice activists, Brown negotiated directly with California's powerful oil and gas industry. According to the news magazine In These Times, Brown crafted legislation behind closed doors and relied on talking points developed by the regional oil lobby, the Western State Petroleum Association. As negotiations went forward in Sacramento, climate activists were pushing for vigorous carbon reduction goals and aid for communities hurt by the fossil fuel industry. A cap-and-trade reform bill could have been a positive departure from current cap-and-trade regulations and would have barred the stockpiling of carbon credits, making them less vulnerable to the kind of speculation that triggered the 2008 financial crisis. The final compromise legislation, however, left current cap-and-trade regulations largely intact. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
An estimated 100,000 activists from across Europe and elsewhere converged on Hamburg, Germany, to engage in multi-issue protests at the Group of 20, or G20 summit meeting, July 7th and 8th. U.S. President Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin were among the leaders of the G20 industrial nations who gathered in Hamburg to discuss trade, immigration, terrorism, and human rights. Although a group of militant protesters received most of corporate media attention due to their running street battles with some of the 20,000 police deployed in Hamburg, most of those protesting were peaceful. Activists who came to Hamburg organized an alternative summit meeting and participated in diverse actions designed to focus attention on issues including ongoing wars, climate change, threats to the environment, economic inequality, and the plight of immigrants. Greenpeace was among the many international non-governmental organizations with a presence in Hamburg, where members staged several actions. Activists in kayaks and small boats wrote the words "End Coal" on a ship delivering 75,000 tons of coal to the German port, while others scaled a city bridge and suspended a large banner with the same message, G20 End Coal. Your reporter spoke with Cassidy Craighill, a media officer with Greenpeace USA, who discusses the climate issues that were the focus of her group's protests at the G20 summit meeting.
Certainly a kind of beehive of activity at the G20, both in the official meetings and on the street. Greenpeace was there, and we obviously are an organization that prioritizes nonviolence. But the G20 certainly is a place where people can see the power imbalance. And so Greenpeace, at these types of events and gatherings on the world stage, pushes the narrative to really shift that power back into the hands of the people rather than corporate interests and the economic elite. So that was certainly one of our priorities there. The Paris Climate Agreement was, of course, one of the top agenda items this year, and we wanted to raise awareness to how much Trump had set us back, but not just the United States, the whole world, and send the message that that was not something that really reflected the needs and desires of people in the United States, but also people around the world. So the G20 is really a unique event where it is such a gathering of the most powerful in the world, but to have such a diverse group of protesters there was really important and I think really shifted the narrative this year.
Now, I know Greenpeace was focused on the continued burning of coal throughout the world, particularly industrial nations. And there was a coal ship, I believe, that was delivering shipment of coal to the Hamburg port. And Greenpeace had a creative way to focus their attention on the continued burning of coal and its contribution to climate change. You want to tell our listeners a bit about what happened with that coal ship?
Sure. And the coal action was one of a few that Greenpeace did during the G20. And the overall message there was that you can't have global climate action without phasing out the burning of coal. And shifting to 100% renewable energy. So we really wanted to point out some of the lip service that is often paid to climate action, but still needs some more substantial, significant steps to phasing out those fossil fuels, including coal, but also, of course, oil and gas, particularly in the United States. So Germany is one of the countries that is still too reliant on coal, yet is seen as a leader on climate change. And so that was a moment to really highlight that you can say all you want at these sorts of meetings, but unless you're actually backing it up with action and actually phasing out those dirty fossil fuel sources and energy sources, then we're really not making the progress at a global level that we need. So that was to really point out that even a country as progressive as Germany is, still has an addiction to fossil fuel that needs to be addressed.
Cassidy, what was the response of the G20 nations to Donald Trump's announcement on June 1st that he's pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord? From what I understood, a lot of these leaders did reaffirm their commitment to the Paris Accord, some even bolstering their commitments that were made originally. But you could provide us a summary of some of the response of these world leaders to the Trump pullout.
Like you said, the rest of the G20 or the G19 really now needs to double down on their commitments. And I think it's up to people around the world to push those countries to do so, particularly ones that are in such a great position to do so. So Europe, Canada, Asian countries, I think all realize that they need to double down on those commitments and are doing so. I think at this point, of course, having the United States in that agreement would help. But the fact of the matter is that there are so many other forces in the United States that are moving forward with that progress. The leading companies in this country, from Apple to Google to Facebook, are making their own commitments. Mayors around the country, from Virginia to San Francisco, to the Southwest, all four corners and of the country are making their own commitments and moving forward on them. So I think that it's important for us to signal to the rest of the world that despite the president of the United States not listening to the majority of scientists in the world and not joining respected leaders in this agreement, that the rest of the United States is going to do so. And I think it's important for other leaders, particularly in the developing world, that in countries like India, to continue to push Trump to rethink this decision. They may be the only ones who have that leverage, and it's important for them. But in the meantime, Trump is not any sort of person to reason with. They need to be even more ambitious about their original commitments.
That was Cassidy Craighill, a media officer with Greenpeace USA. Find more news and commentary on the G20 summit meeting by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. At the close of its 85th annual meeting on June 26th, the United States Conference of Mayors, for the 12th consecutive year, adopted a strong resolution put forward by a coalition called Mayors for Peace, which called on President Trump to lower nuclear tensions, prioritize diplomacy, and redirect nuclear weapons spending to meet human needs and address environmental challenges, which was sponsored by Mayor Frank Crowney of Des Moines, Iowa, and 19 other co-sponsors. The Mayor's Conference also unanimously passed two complementary resolutions, one which opposed the Trump administration's proposal to move $54 billion from human and environmental spending at home and abroad to military spending, sponsored by Mayor Svante Mierick of Ithaca, New York. The other resolution called on cities across the U.S. to hold public hearings to explore what they could do with funds if major cuts were made to the nation's military budget. The resolution also urged cities to pass motions locally demanding reductions in military spending, moving the money saved to fund cities, and sending the resolution to members of Congress asking for their response. That resolution was submitted by New Haven, Connecticut Mayor Tony Harp, whose own city passed such a resolution in February. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus visited Mayor Harp in her office recently and spoke with her about the resolution she initiated and the differing responses to her call for reductions in military spending since the advent of the Trump presidency.
This resolution that looks at our federal spending on our war apparatus and sort of moving into peacetime operation just made sense in light of an administration that actually wants to pour more dollars into our armed forces and our war apparatus. It's going in the exact opposite way than we thought we were going, 2 years ago.
Do you feel like, you know, there's resistance growing to the Trump administration in ways that could be effective, or do you fear that with the federal government reestablishing its priorities in a very different way that you're going to have a hard time in the future?
Well, you know, I think that we are in a very precarious place in America, that you have in North Korea a very unstable leader who now claims that he can get a warhead, a nuclear warhead, to American lands. And we have a president who doesn't seem to be at all concerned that the world really cannot contemplate nor have a nuclear war, and really uses language and tweets that I think endanger the American people. So having said that, and then decides that it's going to use the resources of the American people, not for Medicaid, not for Meals on Wheels, not for youth at work, not for any of the labor programs, and is going to use it so that it can play this game with the rest of the world that really leverages all of our lives. I'm very worried about it. And I think other mayors are too. And when you look at cities in America, almost all of the cities are blue, which basically means they care a lot about communities, people, and making sure they have the resources to care for people. But oftentimes they're in red states. And the way in which our democracy has been designed with the Electoral College makes it a red state like Wyoming have more say, basically, or an individual in that state have more say than people in a blue state with more population have. The few get to decide where the many go. And that is a problem, and it is dangerous, and I'm worried about it. I think most mayors are.
You said a lot of cities, most cities are blue, but there were Republican mayors here.
Oh, there were absolutely Republican mayors there, and not all of them are blue, but some of the major cities typically with the larger populations are blue in the United States, oftentimes in red states. And so it creates a bit of a problem. But most all of those cities that are blue, they are standing behind the Paris Climate Pact. They are standing behind and fighting for the resources that the people in their cities need at the federal level. And, you know, they're putting pressure on Congress to really be a balance of power. Again, you know, Congress is laid out with largely Republican, although in the cities that are represented by these folks, there's still a lot of pressure. They've got to go home to say why they don't want to pay for medical care for people, why they don't want to make sure that poor people who can't afford food don't have access to it. And so hopefully at the local level, holding our federal leaders' feet to the fire, we can move away from what appears to be somewhat suicidal. You know,
but you did say the resolution passed unanimously. Was that right?
Yeah, it passed.
Okay. So even these Republican mayors thought it was okay.
Thought it was okay.
I wonder, do you think that's because they thought it didn't really require? I mean, every city could do what it wanted to, I guess.
Well, I think that part of it is that, you know, you are bringing decision making back to the local area in a way that's really very bright, because what happens is that you are able then to help people at the local level understand what's at stake. And hopefully it'll start a movement.
That was New Haven, Connecticut Mayor Tony Harp. Learn more about the resolutions adopted at the recent gathering of the U.S. Conference of Mayors by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration-supported narcotics interdiction raid in Honduras in May 2012 that killed four civilians, including two women and a 14-year-old boy, received new attention recently with the May 2017 release of a report by Inspectors General of the Departments of State and Justice. The report refuted an initial account filed by the DEA that stated the Honduran attack on a civilian boat by a DEA-led Honduran police unit and a U.S. machine gun-equipped helicopter was justified, and found that DEA and State Department officials had misled Congress. According to Annie Byrd, director of the Guatemala Human Rights Commission, the attack which took place in the rural Mosquito indigenous community of Hawass on the Honduran Caribbean coast shines a light on the need for close scrutiny of U.S. support for the drug war in Central America. Byrd and Alexander Main of the Center for Economic and Policy Research had visited Hawass several weeks after the May 2012 attack and collected firsthand accounts from survivors and eyewitnesses that directly contradicted the DEA's version of events. Their op-ed piece, titled "The Deadly Results of a DEA-Backed Raid in Honduras," was published in the New York Times on July 2nd. Your reporter reached Annie Byrd in Honduras, where she described the 2012 attack and the need for oversight and investigations by Congress into U.S. security operations and funding for counter-narcotics missions in Central American nations.
The incident that happened in 2012, the killing of 4 innocent bystanders and 3 others were currently disabled, was a very tragic event because it became pretty clear early on that it was the DEA that was directly involved. So the DEA was claiming that it had been a Honduran-led operation and that none of the people involved in the shooting had actually been DEA agents. So I traveled out to Hawass with Alex Main from the Center for Economic and Political Research, and we interviewed witnesses and survivors of the attack, and it became very clear there was a family who was moving from one town to another, had all of their belongings, had the school records for a 14-year-old boy who was killed because he was transferring from one school to the other. The families of 2 of the women said they were pregnant. You know, one of them, the doctor who had been seeing her, affirmed this. And you know, there's all kinds of evidence showing that this was a water taxi and that it was traveling on the river because that's how people in that area travel, and was mistaken by this DEA-led operation. And the DEA then ordered the Honduran gunners on the helicopter to open fire on the boat. It became very clear that the DEA was actually in charge of the operation, that the Honduran agents were under the orders, under the command of the DEA, and that the DEA in the United States was not being honest about that. But then what became even more concerning is that the DEA and State Department began promoting a story in Congress. When Congress began asking questions, that individuals on the water taxi who opened fire on a boat DEA and Honduran police officers were on, and there was no evidence to substantiate that. And in fact, what happened is that there was a witness who essentially lied, admitted she lied, gave contradictory evidence, you know, declarations in 3 different interviews. And so it was a very intentional sort of misleading of Congress and the public. So this whole incident provided a very disturbing sort of window into how the DEA is interacting with Honduran, not only drug networks, but also the corruption in the police forces that they're working with.
Annie, tell us about the issue of accountability here. Your article emphasizes the fact that no one at the Drug Enforcement Administration has been held accountable for the lies and misdirection that they gave State Department and Justice Department investigators.
Exactly, and what the State Department and DEA, what we're hearing that their response is that, well, this Inspector General report that came out with all these very damning findings is no longer relevant because the unit that undertook that operation was dissolved. Well, the fact of the matter is, the way that we see it, the most disturbing aspect of what happened was how the DEA and the State Department dealt with it afterwards by going along with lies, perpetuating, you know, misinformation, promoting false testimony. And all of that, you know, was with the infrastructure, the DEA office in the country, you know, the INL, the International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Unit, the State Department, and they actively participated in undermining the ambassador's chief of mission authority over their operations and in hiding what had actually happened in the operation and how they had later reacted to it.
Your investigation into this situation in Honduras shines a light on a pattern of behavior by the United States in terms of its involvement in Central American governments and the drug trade there that really provides much caution in your mind that the Congress really needs to investigate this and scrutinize very heavily what the USDEA and other security assistance programs are doing to these countries where innocent civilians are being killed, as well as corruption is rife in local police departments and the military.
Exactly. There's this Central America Regional Security Initiative, CARSI, which was created in 2009 and has received billions of dollars, which are completely opaque. Their use, Congress does not know, you know, what those funds are being used for, and we're talking about billions of dollars. And our fear is that that funding, of what we see evidence to suggest, is that some of that funding could actually be promoting networks of corruption and feeding into the power structures of the actual criminal organizations that we're supposed to be combating. I mean, just as a tiny little microcosm example, I have serious reasons to believe and indications that the false witness, who is herself connected to organized crime, was likely paid by either the Honduran government or potentially assistance funds to the Honduran government. She may be intended for witness protection or to promote access to information. And what I've seen in other areas of the country is payments being offered to people to give false testimony, essentially to protect drug traffickers or death squads who are stealing land from cooperative farmers.
That was Annie Bird, director of the Guatemala Human Rights Commission and co-author with Alex Main of the July 2nd New York Times op-ed piece titled "The Deadly Results of a DEA-backed Raid in Honduras." Find links to the article and related information by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WBSU in Brockport, New York, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, KAOS in Olympia, Washington, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.